I've said it several times on the show. Do you know how to get in touch with the FBI if you need to? Well, I called the FBI. An interview with Special Agent in Charge, Matthew DiSarno, of the Dallas Field Office. This is a bonus episode of The Business of Tech. So, Agent DiSarno, I'm so excited to have you on the show today.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate you having us.
So just for context, give everyone a little bit of a sense of what your purview is within the FBI.
Sure. You know, I'm currently the special agent in charge of the FBI's Dallas field office. The Dallas field office covers the northern half of the state of Texas. We've also have field offices in San Antonio, Houston, and El Paso. But I cover everything from Amarillo to Lufkin. So pretty much the northern half of the state. I've been an agent for 20 years. I have significant experience in criminal violations, including violent crime, gang crime, civil rights, white collar, corruption. And then spent a good amount of time in leadership, organizational leadership of our counterterrorism division. I spent time as the head of counterterrorism operations globally. And then I ran our criminal and cyber operations and investigations in our Washington field office. And then for the last 3 years, I've been here in the Dallas field office, where I have responsibility for all programs, all violations. And I spend a good amount of time focused on cyber issues, cyber threats related to criminal actors and national security cyber actors. And I'm real proud of the work that we've done up to this point in the field office in mitigating those threats.
You know, so you're real hands-on, which is exactly why I wanted to get you on to that. And in fact, the reason I thought it was useful to talk about this, we talk a lot in cybersecurity about all of these best practices and the things we should be doing for our customers. But I actually think the area that we as the providers and those focused on providers are failing down is we may not know what law enforcement needs and how that process works. And in fact, I want to start with a really simple question that I suspect most of my listeners wouldn't even know where to start. So you're an MSP, your provider, you're managing your customer's network, and you recognize you've been breached. That moment. And you've got that moment of shock. Is that a crime scene? Am I supposed to hands up? Like, what's from a law enforcement perspective, what's my first movement there?
Yeah, no, thanks for that question, David. I really appreciate it. I think to kind of put that in perspective, it's important to understand. I mean, to answer your question real briefly, I say your first move is to call the FBI, but we'll get into kind of why that is and what are the benefits associated with that. But I think it's important to kind of talk about the overall cyber threat, U.S. government approach to cyber threats and where different entities fit in, because I think that's a point of some misunderstanding sometimes. And I think I don't even think we all agree on the definition of what do we mean when we say cyber. I will tell you this. So the purpose of the FBI cyber, the mission is to impose risk and consequence on cyber adversaries to ensure that the United States safety, security, and confidence in a digitally connected world. The FBI uses our unique authorities, our world-class capabilities, our enduring partnerships to complete an essential mission for the government's effort in an ever-changing, increasingly complex ecosystem. So no agency does this alone, right? We sit right in the middle of this ecosystem. On the defensive side, on the government portion, obviously there are many private sector companies working on the defensive side as well. On the defensive side of cyber, you've got DOD and CISA, whose job it is to protect and provide assistance to the private sector in critical infrastructure and build up defenses. On the offensive side, we've got intelligence agencies that can impose risk and consequence on adversaries. Can work. We and those intelligence agencies work regularly with foreign partners to do that. Right where we sit is right in the middle. Because we are both a law enforcement and an intelligence agency, our job is to respond to incidents, provide attribution, and then help partners impose risk and consequence on adversaries. Sometimes that includes a law enforcement risk or consequence. Sometimes it includes some other type of risk and consequence. But we have broad authorities and a broad footprint and agents, you know, stationed throughout the country, unlike any other U.S. government agency, to physically respond develop the intelligence that we and our partners need to take significant action, which could include arrests, it could include infrastructure takedowns, it could include sanctions, sometimes includes diplomatic pressure, sometimes it's DOD action, sometimes it's a combined combination of those authorities and those outcomes to put that kind of consequence on the actors. It's not a perfect parallel, but in a lot of ways, we're working against cyber threats in the same way we learned to tackle terrorism after 9/11, in two different ways, really. Relentless focus on prevention and disruption, and then setting aside thoughts about credit and feeding information to our partners who are best positioned to hit the adversary. Now, that includes, you know, that includes oftentimes foreign partners, sometimes includes partnering very closely with U.S. private sector. You know, we don't wait till we're done with an investigation to launch a disruption operation or hand information off to our partners. The imperative is action, and we'll continue toward attribution and getting a full picture of attribution. And as that's becoming clear, then we start working across the interagency to create those effects, right? We're both an intelligence and a law enforcement agency. There are no other agencies globally, really, that have those types of combined authorities. And then because we partner with both the intelligence services globally and law enforcement services globally, we've got the ability to really bring or help our partners bring those types of effects against adversaries. So to get back to kind of to your question, you know, CISA clearly is the lead agency for asset response. They're focused on sharing information quickly. Their work is vital to our understanding of what an adversary is planning and doing. And our work against a threat often uncovers new victims or feeds indicators to CISA that helps them harden defenses. And then the overall intelligence community is coordinating efforts across the intelligence community. Our job is to get into, is to interact with the victim, get attribution, and then work with partners to hold, to provide some level of accountability against whoever it is that caused the incident. So, you know, with that being said, a call to the FBI, and we can talk more specifically about what that kind of looks like, but a call to the FBI, in my opinion, is imperative early. It's a key to having any kind of success, and it's also a key to us creating this whole of society approach to defending our cyber ecosystem. Our adversaries are clearly using a whole of society approach because they can, right? They can force it, and they do force it. Because all of U.S. critical infrastructure, the vast majority of it, is in the hands of the private sector, and we can't force that type of collaboration, we have to encourage voluntary collaboration and voluntary protection because, as you know, and as you've seen it said, you know, cybersecurity is really national security, and cyber risk really is business risk. So we've got to come together and build the types of relationships and the types of trust between the private sector and the U.S. government to make sure that we are hardening ourselves appropriately.
Yeah, I think my listeners are very bought into the strategy. In fact, you know, they're generally the ones defending their U.S. company. A lot of U.S. companies working with U.S. small businesses to defend them. So let's make it really practical for them, you know, because it's one thing to talk about partnership at the big level, but I want to try and make it really practical for small providers. Yeah. The you know, 80 some percent of the provider market is less than $10 million in revenue. These are smaller companies. So they're in that moment of shock. And they have now said, okay, I want to call the FBI. Let's make it really practical. Yeah. Like, is there a 1-800 number? Do you start with your finding your field office? Like really, how, from a practical perspective, who's the first call?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And hopefully prior to that call, you know, the company has done a couple things, already had some level of engagement with the FBI. That's not imperative, but it's hopeful. And then second, hopefully that company has an incident response plan that exists, has been practiced. And in that incident response plan, there is a phone number to call. There's a contact, a specific point of person, specific point of contact. And you know, in the absence of that, the call is to either, you could go to ic3.gov and submit an incident report. You could call 1-800-CALL-FBI, or you can call your local field office. Okay. And you will get an immediate response from the FBI. Now, you know, what a good engagement looks like. I can kind of go over that. So the victim reaches out to their local FBI office immediately upon realizing they're a victim of a ransomware attack. Ideally, they know who to call because we've already established the relationship or there's been some sort of outreach done by us already. So our cyber squad responds, right? And we and the victim have an open dialogue about what they know, the type of information we need to best help them. For example, information about how actors got into the network. That helps us warn others and helps us feed into the defensive side of that U.S. government ecosystem. Information that tells us which ransomware variant was used. Obviously, that's critical to us because the way we work ransomware, large ransomware variants, is we have offices that own those variants that have a lot of familiarity with them. So if the victim's in Dallas, but the ransomware variant may be owned by our New York field office, as soon as we can identify that, the Dallas cyber squad will continue engaging with the victim, but that New York field office squad that's expert in that ransomware variant is working the investigative piece of that in an effort, like I said before, to hold someone accountable for it, right? And each of these incidents also provide us additional evidence or clues that we need to pursue people responsible. So we're looking to work with the victim to collect technical evidence that we can run against our databases, share with our partners, and also use in furtherance of attribution. You know, much like a serial killer, cyber actors continue to target additional victims. So every detail we get gets us closer to being in a position to disrupt the ransomware variant, to disrupt the actor, to take some sort of action.
So what I'm interested in there too is this, so say they don't necessarily have, they don't know the variant yet or something, they literally are identifying. Is that okay? Is it okay that they're calling in really early before, you know, literally they may have just discovered and before they start poking at it, is that a good thing or a bad thing to call that early?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that's totally fine, right? I mean, if they don't know, that's completely fine. Now, the reality is most of these net defenders are, and most of your listeners likely are, all over reading threat intelligence all the time. And they do know which variant it is, or at least they know how to give us a marker that tells us very quickly which variant it is. But they should call us whether they know that or not. You know, when certain steps are taken before or during a cyber incident, they help us preserve investigative equities and allows us to also collaborate together without causing retained counsel or in-house counsel lots of problems, right? That we have a challenge with often an incident occurs and either retained counsel or in-house counsel doesn't want to tell anybody about it at all, nothing, put it down. That's challenging for us. That inhibits our collective ability to mitigate the threat. And I think there are things that we can do ahead of time. So, you know, in addition to maintaining the updated incident response plan, I think an MSP should consider creating an information sharing plan that identifies what information and what data is approved to be shared with law enforcement in an incident, right? The plan can be obviously approved by or created with internal or external counsel so that when the incident happens, we already know we're talking to the FBI and this is what we're giving them. And we are approved to give them this information, right? I think another key thing to maintain as an MSP or as any potential victim is an up-to-date network diagram. Includes hardware, software configurations, connectivity between your infrastructure and that of your downstream customers or third parties. If that's up-to-date, we can mitigate much more quickly. Obviously, the company can mitigate much more quickly, but we can also use that for investigative progress very quickly. Another key thing to maintain is a list of the organization's IP space, its public footprint, right? To include major ingress and egress points to the internet and external connection points to downstream customers so that, you know, we can see that, you can share that with us, and we can start to provide warning to other people, right? It's important to collect and segregate network, server, and endpoint logs concurrent with or prior to a remediation effort, right? This promotes investigative and attribution work while also helping victims analyze the breadth of the impact, what data was lost. you would be shocked, your listeners would be shocked at some of the lack of logging that we see out there. And then where forensic images or packet captures of images impacted infrastructure are collected, obviously we want those preserved. We want to maintain a clear chain of custody of those things in case we have the ability to use those in some sort of legal process.
Right.
And then, you know, we want to leverage out-of-band communications with incident response team members and law enforcement. Communicating incident response effort on potentially compromised systems is clearly not a good idea, right? And then the case of ransomware, any communication with the malicious actors, any ransom negotiations, any virtual currency wallets, any types of selectors like that, those are critical pieces of information that help us potentially recover ransom payments and also make seizures of ransom payments down the line.
If somebody's calling in really early, are you recommending or not recommending people engage with the threat actors to even discuss ransom?
So that's kind of situationally dependent, right? If someone's calling in early, my experience has been by the time they're calling us on a ransomware attack, they are already engaged with that ransomware actor in some sort of a negotiation, or they've already retained a third party to do that. Because we're asking for quick calls. The reality is we're getting those calls after that, those initial steps have already been taken. You know, I would say negotiating with ransomware actors is something that we would like to certainly have firsthand participation in. If you compare it to a kidnapping for ransom or a terrorist hostage taking situation, we would never want the family of a kidnapped victim to be negotiating with people demanding ransom without our ability to influence that with our crisis negotiators, our experts, and our attempts to gain investigative advantage during those negotiations and to glean investigative evidence during those negotiations. So, you know, the bottom line answer to your question is we want to be sitting right next to you or be in pushing those keys on the keyboard with you while that negotiation is going on, because that in a ransom situation, whether it's ransomware, a kidnapping for ransom, or a terrorist hostage taking, that's the advantage of those things, is that the bad guy communicates with you. That's the vulnerability that they leave.
So let's take the magic wand for a moment and let's take a customer and their MSP where you are the first call. You get called before they've engaged with the ransomware actor. Like, what does that unlock in terms of resources that you can put into incident response?
At any time for the call, we're going to start to bring resources. So what we've done, typically how we will evaluate the level of response and resources have to do with impact, right? You know, we've seen some clearly extremely impactful ransomware attacks. JBS Foods, Kaseya was very impactful. Colonial Pipeline, significantly impactful, right? If a company that is either a third party supply chain provider, MSP like Kaseya, you know, we're bringing everything we can bring. We're bringing CAT teams, which are our specialized teams, to go on site. We're working at the highest levels of government. The ransomware attack has visibility, and we're working to push information to policymakers as we're learning who's responsible for it. You know, we are working very closely with CISA, sharing indicators. We're sharing indicators with domestic and foreign intelligence agencies to try to both push attribution and take some action against the adversary. And that's all happening very quickly. On the other hand, if Joe's Trucking, six truck operation with eight employees and an annual revenue of $100,000 a year gets hit with a ransomware attack, you know, we're certainly not going to push every resource we got. We will engage with that victim. We'll be looking to what other potential victims have connectivity with Joe's Trucking. What are the indicators of compromise? What was the variant? And then we'll refer that and likely coordinate also with CISA to help them harden their defenses. But really, you know, the total scope of the resources in a large scale or an impactful ransomware attack or an impactful nation state cyber actor attack are significant. I mean, we've got people all over the country, cyber experts all over the country, in large numbers. We've got the ability to move large numbers of people to the problem, and then we're connected to all of the private sector and intelligence community partners we need to be connected to really bring significant resources to the problem.
So what's the process like? So you've called in, you made your report, you've started engaged. Kind of walk me through the life cycle of the case.
So, as we come in, the early engagement is going to be critical to our success. We're going to have agent as much as necessary. We'll have agents on scene with the victim. In some cases, that's less necessary because we can remote in, or we can work at a data center and get that done. Often, if it's a ransomware case and it's a high profile, high impact ransomware case, there are demand signals from Washington for information, and some of those demand signals go right from the highest levels of our government straight to the company, right? They often go, if the victim is in energy, the Secretary of Energy may be reaching out to the CEO and asking questions about how bad is this? How, Colonial Pipeline or JBS Foods, for instance, food supply, how bad is this going to be to the U.S. food supply in the next 72 hours? How about in the next 2 weeks? In the backdrop of all that, I think, in my opinion, a significant mitigating factor for the leadership of a company that is a victim of this is to be able to say, we are working very closely with the FBI. We have also hired, a remediation service and just go through all the steps that they are doing. So while we're working our case, what's also happening is a crisis response internally in the victim company to mitigate, remediate, rebuild, and get business back up and running. And we've unfortunately have enough practice at this to know how to collect the evidence we need, engage with the victim as we need to, and not be disruptive to that mitigation and reconstitution effort on the part of the victim.
Yeah. So what kind of protections do you offer for both the information and sort of how the provider is going to be viewed during the process?
The first instinct is to not call anybody, right? Or call my lawyer and don't tell law enforcement. I think the more quickly you can give us technical details about the attack, the more quickly we can help. If we can get quick access to cyber incident reports, link the intrusion to other FBI investigations, work with our intelligence community partners, we can provide technical information to those victims to stop ongoing incidents or to potential victims and prevent activity. We treat cyber victims like we treat all victims. A trusted partner who's assisting us, but they are the victim of a crime. And we don't go around giving out victim information. There's always going to be a concern on the part of a general counsel or a third party counsel that, hey, if these guys end up indicting somebody, this is going to come out that you were the victim. But the reality is it often comes out anyway. It's likely in the information environment that we're in that someone is going to divulge the fact that a company was a victim. For us, if we open a grand jury investigation and we are investigating it as a criminal activity and the company is the victim, we're prohibited from sharing that information. Now, if it's public knowledge that the victim has been hit and people know it and it's out there, then we work directly with the victim on messaging in a way that allows the victim company to often push that message themselves, or to make sure that whatever we are messaging, if we are allowed to message anything, is consistent with what the victim's messaging. If the victim is in fact messaging truthfully, if there's a disconnect there, then we generally don't say anything. Right. That's kind of how that works. But I think it's. I think it's just important to know that, you know, notifying the FBI is not likely to be the reason why the public becomes aware of your breach. There are plenty of other reasons why the public was going to become aware of your breach, and they will, unless you're Joe's Trucking and you have six trucks and $100,000 a year in revenue, then they might never know about it.
But so we've talked a little bit about how the call works, the kind of information you've talked to, you've given us some insights into the prep that would help. And you've talked about sort of the process, but I'm going to ask kind of a simple question for most of these providers, particularly because if you're doing a good job before your breach, how do I build a relationship with the FBI? Do I call you guys up and visit? Like, is it like, What is that? How do I build a relationship with the FBI in preparation for the eventual, I'm probably going to need them?
No, that's a great question. And I'll tell you that here in Dallas, and I know that my colleagues around the country and the other 55 FBI field offices, we are making an effort to conduct outreach. And I know that we are open to any outreach from any company. Obviously, there are so many thousands of potential cyber victims out there that becomes a real challenge. So there are a few key ways to do it, right? We have formal programs like DSAC, our Domestic Security Alliance Council. That is a corporate membership. It requires certain revenue numbers and connectivity to critical infrastructure that the company can be a member of that. There's also InfraGuard, which is an individual membership. That neither of these are they're both affiliated with the FBI, but they are their own 501c3 organizations that are focused on domestic security, cybersecurity issues. And the FBI shares significant information through those channels. There are also and those channels have portals that have threat intelligence all the time. Here in Dallas, we do multiple different seminars throughout the year with different groups, typically industry specific, but often broader than that. And then we maintain, we send out an email update that's got my cyber supervisor's names on the bottom of it, with key updates about twice a month to a large list of people who we know in the area to be cyber net defenders. People who are in industry that are contacts of ours right now. Every time I meet someone or my cyber supervisors meet someone from a different company or someone that is interested in learning more about having a relationship with us and protecting their organizations, we add them to that list. And then we have interaction with them, but there's nothing preventing anyone from calling their local FBI office and saying, I'm a net defender at X company and I don't know anyone in the office. I'd really like to talk to somebody in general about cybersecurity and my role and incident response. And you will get a call back from an FBI agent, a cyber agent, or a cyber supervisor who can have a relationship. Well,
I think you've given us that action item at the end of something to do with. Agent DeSardo, I really appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you very much, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.